And this is Henrik Palmgren. We are glad that you're back with us, or if you're with us for the first time, a warm welcome to everyone, however and whenever you are tuning in. We go out worldwide over the internet. Our website is redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. This is investigative radio, interviews and reports on a vast area of subjects that we find both important and interesting, and also hopefully helpful and insightful to you. Today we're talking with Allison Adams about mercury toxicity, the mouth-body connection, and natural recovery. Allison is a dentist, naturopath, and former fatigue-related syndromes sufferer. She holds UK and US degrees in dentistry and have 8 diplomas in various aspects of natural health. She suffered with a lifetime of chronic illnesses, which resulted in a health crisis that forced her to quit her profession of 20 years, realizing that the conventional medical approach offered no real solution to her condition. She began retraining in naturopathic medicine. Allison finally recovered her health using the natural approaches that she discovered. We'll talk about her road to recovery and many of the lessons learned along the way. Hi, Allison. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. We appreciate it. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, very well. Thank you, Henrik, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you bet. I think we should begin with your background story, how you came to study and learned about health, toxicity, and everything else that's related to it. Tell us what happened to you, Allison, and a little bit of your story, if you will.
Okay. Well, like most people, I was brought into natural health through health problems of my own. I was born late, to a mother who was about 40 when she had me, and into a family with a big history of autoimmune disorders. Particularly on my father's side, a lot of my female relatives on my father's side have died in their 40s or 50s of rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and, you know, thyroid disorders, that sort of thing. So right from the get-go, things probably weren't good. I certainly had very compromised health as a child. I had lots of antibiotics, lots of tummy pains, that sort of thing. I was referred for musculoskeletal problems when I was about 5 and had 7 years of treatment for that. I then had hearing loss and had what turned out to be the first of 18 operations when I was about 10 for that. And so it went on. And then I hit puberty and my health took a nosedive then as well. And then I was put on the pill very young. And on and on. So yeah. I just have never felt well, really. Some of this may have been because I was an undiagnosed celiac, and I still don't know the truth of that to this day. You know, and perhaps we can touch on that later. But anyway, so that aside, I studied dentistry at the then Guy's Dental School in London. It's now known as United Medical and Dental Schools. And graduated in the UK. I then worked in general practice for a few years. All the time, my health was getting worse. I had endocrine problems and digestive problems and so forth. And then I went and studied restorative dentistry at the University of Michigan and did a master's degree there for 2 years. And came back and worked in general practice for a little bit for somebody else. And during that time, one of my nurse's assistants didn't put an amalgam cartridge in a mixing machine properly, and it flew out, hit the wall. For those of your listeners that don't know, amalgam is half liquid mercury and half powdered metals, and the mercury scattered, and we never did find it. And I didn't take that nearly as seriously as I should have done. We did get a kind of sniffer in and look for it, but we never found it. And I had no idea how serious that was, continuing to work in that room with a mercury vapor problem. Anyway, in retrospect, I can see that my health took a distinct turn for the worse then. But I carried on, and I had my own practice in central London for about 7 years after that. And then I had a series of miscarriages, and my health just completely failed. I couldn't carry on. And so I had to, at that stage, I had a big fat file with the doctors. They're actually remarkably uninterested in the labels I was given, which was chronic fatigue, autoimmune disease, fibromyalgia. And I just got no help or no interest at all. And I realized that, you know, they were really going to leave me to die at that stage because it was that serious. And so realizing that, I took matters into my own hands and decided to research the matter. And I started off because I have always been sympathetic to alternative treatments. I was never against them, but I had been trained in the allopathic system. So it was that I kind of turned to first and looked through all the research papers and all that sort of thing, and then kind of quickly gave up on that. And then a series of synchronous events brought me into studying allergy therapy and kinesiology, both of which use muscle testing to dialogue with somebody's body and to determine what the real problems are. And using that, I started to unravel my health and sort of think about things in a different way. And then once I qualified, I did other adjunctive diplomas. I did 8 in total, so nutrition and so forth. Anyway, so once I'd actually qualified and I'd been working for a little bit, I did a postgraduate course put together by somebody called Dietrich Klinghardt, who's a German neurobiologist and doctor, and he has developed a way of uncovering hidden toxins using a kind of muscle testing technique. And once I knew how to do that, everybody I tested showed to mercury toxicity. And by this stage, I was starting to acknowledge that this was what was wrong with me, that I had personal, occupational, and accidental mercury exposure. But I also started to realize that it was very commonplace and you know, that it was a huge problem in the population at large. It's taken me many years to detox the mercury, and I've gone through some pretty horrible detoxification symptoms along the way. And I'm not completely better now, but I am hugely better, and I've got my life back, and I'm starting to feel, you know, really like I can actually say I'm recovered now.
Wow.
And I was just starting to pull my health together after all of that when I was out walking and I got hit by a motorbike from behind. I was actually airlifted to hospital with a suspected broken back or neck and a known broken leg. So I've been recovering not only from that trauma and the break, but also I didn't want the metal rod left in my leg. So I had elective surgery last year to have that removed. So I've had a further load of, you know, rehabilitation and things to do with that. So the last 10 years has been challenging on many fronts.
I can imagine. How long ago was the motorbike accident?
It was about 2 years and 9 months, something like that.
So not that long ago then. Really.
No. I'm starting to feel like I'm leaving it behind me now, but of course, the legal ramifications and everything rumble on. So,
Wow. Yeah, what a path. And of course, as we know, going that such a dark road, of course, if one can get through it, will have a lot of benefits, because we learn tremendously during a road like that or walking that path. But the mercury poisoning is a kind of a different section. I want to get into that later, of course. A lot of this has to do with toxicity connected to dentistry and all these horrible effects, of course. But if we talk a little bit about before that, what was wrong before you had this potential mercury leak, if you will, in the dentistry office there? What was wrong with the way you were living before that? Were you still plagued by mercury? Did you have amalgam in your teeth and stuff like that?
Well, again, yes, I did. I had the usual story of I had a kind of fairly diligent mother who took me for all the required vaccinations. So I'd had, you know, I don't know, dozens of vaccinations. I also had about 16, 17 amalgam filling, something like that, a lot of which were done all in one go, because when I went to dental school, they screen you, and they found out that I'd been neglected by my hometown dentist. So I had most of those fillings done in the space of about 3 months. And looking back, you know, I can see that I started to really struggle after that, and then various other turning points in my life as well, when I had some gold crowns fitted, and then I had root canals done further down the tracks, and you can see, you know, the toxic effect of each of these, as I say, through the retrospective scope. But I don't think you can separate out what was wrong from the issue of, well, the toxic metals that we use in dentistry and the procedures as well. Yeah. And unfortunately, I've come to a lot of this understanding, you know, since I finished in my practicing life, and over the last 10 years, it's kind of unfolded a lot of this. But I certainly want to try and get dentists on board, and I want to educate the public so they can make informed decisions too.
Indeed. You were mentioning some of Dietrich Klinghardt's methods of, I think this, you said it was related to muscle testing and kinesiology, things like that. And you said everyone you tested, you found that there basically were mercury poisoning. Tell us a little bit more about that. Who did you test, and what is all this related, do you think, to just the tooth decay industry, dentistry, whatever you want to call it? Or is it from something else? Is there mercury in our environment due to, you know, fish and everything else? What do you think?
Well, yes to all the above, really. We excrete, most people excrete mercury very poorly. And in fact, it, you know, one piece of research showed that within 1 month of placing an amalgam filling in a sheep, that 50% of kidney function was lost. So you're functioning with one kidney basically after you've had one amalgam filling done. So the routes of excretion are actually shut down by the mercury itself. So you get it from a load of sources, and it depends upon your innate capacity to detoxify. It depends upon your diet, how stressed you are, you know, whether you take supplements, exercise, also a whole host of factors, including what kind of dental work you've had done and when, and what vaccinations and all that sort of thing, all of which confuses the issue, so that, you know, there hasn't been a really clear link for some people as to cause and effect. As to the mercury, but my mother had mental illness problems right from early adulthood, I would say. She's now got Alzheimer's/dementia. My father ended his life with Alzheimer's/dementia as yes. well, so I don't have a particularly high chance of avoiding it myself. But it is my opinion that I acquired a toxic load from my mother at birth. I've got one older brother. Some of this may be relevant as we go through. I've got one older brother who's 10 years older than me. So my mum had 10 years between giving birth to him when she was 30 and giving birth to me when she was 40. So she had 10 years then to accumulate toxins. And they've shown this, you know, quite clearly. And this is true of, you know, dolphins and things like that. It is said that 70% of pregnancies actually miscarry in humans. And often it goes undetected because the woman just thinks it was a late period, a heavy period or something like that. But certainly in dolphins, they're looking at a lot of the firstborn are dying in utero or being miscarried or whatever. And effectively, the mother is detoxifying into her offspring. And then they're acquiring more mercury and other toxic metals, the mother's toxic burden kind of in general, through breast milk as well. So in that way, they say between a third and two-thirds of the mother's toxin burden is transferred to each child, and depending upon your birth order and how much gap there's been, and, you know, whether your mother's had fillings or vaccinations between, you know, you and any older siblings, that sort of thing. So you're born carrying a load, and then of course they start vaccinating you practically from the moment of birth. It depends which country you're in, but, you know, there's I think, you know, 24 vaccinations required in the UK before children start school. And yeah. That's got all kinds of repercussions. That includes, or certainly did in, you know, in days gone by, a preservative called thimerosal, which is about, it's metabolized by the body to ethyl mercury. So that's another source.
Yeah, that's right.
There are environmental sources as well. Volcanoes do spit out mercury, and there's lots of mercury produced in various industries as well, chloralkali production, refuse, incineration, hospital waste, you know, there's a number of man-made environmental sources as well as natural man-made sources, and natural sources rather, and also that recirculates in the environment as well, so it gets kind of, you know, brought up into the atmosphere and then brought down as rain and then into the waterways and so forth. So
the mercury, it doesn't go away. It's there in its form as it exists all the time, basically.
Pretty much. They do say it eventually goes into long-term sink, whatever that means. So eventually it must find its way through the outer crust of the earth into, you know, some deep water reserves where it doesn't reappear. But yes, basically it's being recirculated all the time.
Wow. So what effects does mercury poisoning have, and when should we, I guess, classify it as being poisoning? I mean, these are very, very small amounts that are necessary, of course, to begin to affect the human body in different ways, in negative ways. But as we know as well, the so-called accepted levels or okay levels released by government and such, is they're always, you know, putting that pretty high up and never take into account the fact that these things will have, no matter how small amounts we you know, are exposed to, they will have a negative effect on us, correct?
They do. And they have, you know, there are hundreds of symptoms of mercury toxicity. And this is part of the problem, because there's not, you know, an absolute clear link between one disease and mercury toxicity. The other thing with mercury is it's hugely toxic. It actually is made more toxic. We can perhaps go into this, but there are different forms, and it's made in from its inorganic form or its elemental form into its organic form within the body, within the ecosystem of the body, by bacteria and what have you, which is what you find happening in the larger ecosystem as well. Inorganic and elemental mercury and that we've just been talking about in pollution, it's carried into waterways. It's then converted by bacterial plankton into organic mercury. Little fish eat the plankton, bigger fish eat the little fish, and then we eat the big fish. And so we're the top of a food chain. And it accumulates in that form, in the organic form. It is incredibly biopersistent. And that's why there's such an issue around eating, you know, fish like tuna and shark and the really big fish, because they live for a long time and they're big. So they've accumulated.
So they accumulate, yeah, amounts of mercury in their system, yeah?
Yeah, well, up to a million fold, actually, wow. It is said, from you know, the base source. So that happens within the body. I can't remember what you asked me now. Oh, yes, the other thing with mercury is it's hugely synergistic with all sorts of other toxins, but particularly other metals. So that the amount of mercury that would kill 1% of lab rats and the amount of aluminium that would kill 1% of lab rats combined will kill all the lab rats. So you've got this huge synergy of mercury with other toxins. And in my opinion, it's not always the cause. It's not, you know, there are, of course, BPAs and all sorts of other things. But if you can pull the metal out, if you can pull toxic metals and particularly mercury out, you lose this huge synergy with all the other poisons. And actually, if you help your body to get rid of the toxic metals, it can often cope with all the other things, the BPAs and all the other horrible plastics and what have you. But it does need help.
So again, it's an accumulative thing that we have when we have onslaught from many different angles. Eventually, our body can't deal with it and detox. But if we get certain elements out, like mercury, our body would have much better chance to actually withstand some of these other chemicals that we have in our environment.
Yes, in my opinion, as I say, it's not the only toxin to which we are exposed, but it's the toxin to which most people are most exposed, but is most detrimental to health. And if you can just, you know, absolutely focus in on that, because I had done various different kinds of detoxing before I really got onto the mercury detox. And you know, I mean, my health was kind of improving, but it was very obvious when I started the mercury detox that something was going on, not least of which is because I had some horrible symptoms. But I was actually willing to go through that, because at that stage I didn't feel I had an alternative. It was, you know, the medical profession weren't offering me anything. So, and since then I've really come to see things in a whole different way. I think most of what allopathic medicine, which is, you know, what people may think of as conventional or modern medicine, we don't like to use those words because we don't think, you know, it has any particular authority.
Yeah.
It's only been around for, well, you know, mostly since the Second World War, really.
Well, that's right. It's fairly new, and it's amazing that they call it orthodox medicine when it's like it's the newcomer on the scene, you know? So,
absolutely. It's the new kid on the block. I mean, you know, some people reckon that Chinese medicine has been around for 12,000 years. And, you know, if you look at the frequency with which drugs, you know, are trumpeted and come onto the scene and then get shown to have all sorts of side effects and they're not used anymore, pulled out of service, that sort of thing. I mean, it's got a very short cycle, you know, of 5 to 10 years. And often the pharmaceutical companies know about it before they even release the drug. But, you know, they've kind of massaged research or whatever.
That's right.
So that, you know, if you think something stood the test of time over 12,000 years, you know, there's got to be something in it. And in fact, kinesiology is based upon Chinese medicine. There was a man called George Goodhart, Dr. George Goodhart, in the 1950s, who was a chiropractor, and he actually figured out the links between specific muscles and points on the body and meridians and the Chinese meridian system. And that, for me, just put a piece into place that brought everything together once I knew about that.
Very good. I want to obviously talk about your road to recovery, a lot of things that you discovered kind of along the way, and get into you know, some other people's work that you found beneficial, because there's a lot, of course, to pull together in this, and we want to mention some. You've written quite extensively about this as well. You have a number of books out there. You have a number of websites as well. And we'll get to all of that as Alison and give out all that information. But tell us about the basic road to recovery for you, kind of where this path began for you, and we'll get into kind of what you've discovered along the way. What would be a good place, I guess, for someone to begin who wants to try to get healthy, basically.
Okay, well, a couple of things, really. One is the understanding naturopathy says that, you know, practically all disease is either toxicity or deficiency. It's not complicated. There aren't thousands of different routes to illness. There are two main routes to illness, and they're completely overlooked by the allopathic medical profession.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, they don't accept that toxicity causes disease, and second of all, they know nothing at all about nutrition except for, you know, pellagra and various kind of obscure, you know, uncommon nutritional deficiencies. So first of all, if you're sick, you're probably toxic or deficient, and you need to work out, you know, which of those. Most people are toxic, and it's worth, I think, referring to the work of, there was a researcher called Francis Pottinger, and he did work in, I think, the 1930s, and he was breeding cats at the time, and he was using their adrenal glands to make extracts and things to give to patients. And he started to look at the state their adrenal glands were in. And he actually divided them up into two lots and kept them so that one lot of cats had raw meat and raw milk, which is, you know, well, a cat probably wouldn't drink milk in, you know, in the wild, but so untampered food and raw. And then the other category, lots of cats, he gave cat food and pasteurized milk, which is what most cats would get, you know, today. I mean, as I said, this was 1930s. And then he watched them over the generations. And what he found was that whilst the cats that were given the raw food stayed strong and, you know, active, glossy fur, were able to reproduce, were kind of fairly easy to handle, that sort of thing, the cats that were fed the processed diet, for want of a better word, actually became chronically sick over the course of 2-3 generations. They became, the males became very docile and kind of asexual. They became very bad-tempered and hard to handle, this sort of thing. And they became unable to reproduce within about 3 or 4 generations. And my fear is that this is what we're looking at with humanity.
That's right.
That we've had a century now of, you know, processed foods, toxins, etc., and we're in a pretty parlous state.
Yeah.
When you look around.
Well, look at the number of cells, and look at what's going on with all the dysfunction and diseases. But on top of that as well, infertility, and it doesn't look good, does it?
It doesn't look good. And I think there are a couple of main causes. There's the work of Weston Price, and I know you've covered this recently, but I think it's worth mentioning his work.
Oh, definitely. Let's talk more about
well.
That.
Yes. Yep. Well, just for people who don't know, he was a dentist, and he graduated in about 1893 from my alma mater, which was the University of Michigan. He actually had a son. He went into general practice, and he had a son called Donald, who he did a root canal filling on, and who died as a consequence of an infection associated with the root canal filling, and it was their only child. And he spent the rest of his life trying to look at, you know, I think heartbroken, really, and looking at the causes of this.
Yeah.
And he spent 25 years looking at root canals, which we may touch upon later, and did some just astounding research there. He had a team of 60 researchers and produced hundreds of papers and huge books on the subject, meticulous research. And then he turned his attention to the causes of decay. That was his primary motivation. And he started to look at native peoples the world over. And this is in the 1930s, he started traveling to these places. He clocked up over 100,000 air miles, apparently, which, you know, when you listen to his travels and how he got to these places, because this wasn't easy in the 1930s. Anyway, he went all over the world. He, you know, went to Aboriginals, African tribes, Alaskan, Scottish Islands, valleys in Switzerland, all this sort of thing. And he documented, he's basically on the scene for when our modern diet arrived and affected these people.
Yeah, like before, and in some of these tribes, before the quote-unquote modern and civilized, you know, way of life managed to get to them. So there was still a, at this stage, there was still some local customs in place, was more local cultural, tribes, if you will. And he tried to document basically how they lived and what they ate and everything.
He did, yes. And he took tens of thousands of slides of these people. And, you know, without exception, they have beautiful, beautifully developed bodies and faces, wide faces, broad smiles. There's no dental disease, there's no gum disease, there's no tooth decay. They fitted all their teeth in straight, even. They were strong, robust people. He took samples of food back and then analyzed them and found that compared to our diet, you know, they had up to 10 times the amount of vitamins in their diet that we have. And he also looked at the archaeological record as well and found just robust skeletons and skulls going back, you know, thousands of years, showing that these people had reproduced perfectly. And then, you know, the ships came in with the white flour and the sugar and the rice and polished rice and, you know, cans of meat and, you know, canned fruit and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, within a matter of a few years, they had just, their health had just gone to hell, basically. They had gum disease, tooth decay, and they didn't have any access to dentistry in these places, because it is worth saying that, you know, these people had these beautiful teeth and mouths and faces, but they had no access to any medical or dental care. These are people who had never had contact with, you know, the so-called civilization before.
There wasn't any need for it. It wasn't in existence. I mean,
absolutely.
They mentioned it, Alison, in going back to Egypt, that they found, you know, evidence of people doing dentistry there. But also think the amount of bread and stuff like that they were eating there. I think that was a luxury for some of the, you know, pharaonic, that they had, they could have the time and the manpower to grow, you know, large amounts of fields and everything else. This is like a, bread is like a delicacy, you know what I mean? This white flour, it's like a rare thing, you know?
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I'll just finish this thought. Bring me back to that if I forget. But
sure,
because what he found is when the processed food diet came in, as I say, they started to have mental health problems, they started to get infectious diseases, they started to get degenerative diseases, and the before and after pictures are really, you know, very compelling and pitiful, really. And because these people got no help at all, you know, once they'd got an abscess or something like that. And in fact, it was the leading cause of suicide, dental problems in these tribes where there was just no help to be had. If you've had toothache, and you can imagine, you know, not getting any help permanently.
Yeah.
So, but the other effect that it had is for mothers that were eating this diet while they were pregnant, and for mothers that were eating this diet while they were breastfeeding and giving it to their children, they just didn't develop properly. The faces didn't develop properly. They got very narrow jaws, which led to, you know, what we perceive as tooth crowding, but it's actually underdevelopment of the jaws, and particularly the upper jaw. And then that leads to a whole cascade of consequences, because the whole thing's not developing as a functional unit, and then you get, you know, misaligned bites and the need for orthodontics, and perhaps we'll touch on that as well. But they also kind of, a bit like a plant that is bolts, they kind of grew quite tall but slim, so that their rib cages didn't develop properly, their pelvises didn't develop in the full width and things, leading to problems in childbirth, because he documented, you know, that this really wasn't an issue in native tribes. Childbirth just wasn't feared. It wasn't a huge issue. One, example he gives in one of the books is that there was a woman, I think an Inuit woman, married to a Caucasian man, and I think she'd had 11 children, but she'd had three or four of them in the middle of the night and hadn't wanted to wake her husband because he needed his sleep. And you know, when you think of the, you know, hoopla around giving birth now, the very fact that she could have got through three or four births in the middle of the night and not disturbed her husband, I think speaks volumes. So the thing was that he was, what Weston Price was saying was that a lot of what we think of as genetic defects, he called intercepted heredity. And now this is in the 1930s, before they knew about DNA and all of this stuff. But, you know, the impact of his work is that we've created these illnesses, either by the mother having eaten this nutrient-deficient diet, you know, beforehand, during pregnancy, during breastfeeding, when the children are small, and then giving the children this food as well. And what you were saying about the pharaohs having access to bread when nobody else did, I don't know if they use this expression elsewhere, but we talk about chinless wonders in the UK. This is the kind of upper classes, you know, the nobility. Yeah. But and of course they're inbred, you know, which could be account for one some of it. But also, they've had access to refined food for longer than the rest of us, you know, the peasant class. So, you know, we've been eating whole grains, stone ground or whatever, and they've had access to, you know, what we would think of as the finest food, but it's not done them many favours. And over the generations, you can see this kind of, you know, lack of development of the face to the point where the chins aren't developing properly and all the rest of it. So,
yeah, wow.
May not be a blessing.
No. Well, this is the thing. Exactly. We think of it as a natural thing today, but that this was a luxury in the past. I mean, this is like, I guess maybe a stupid analogy, but this is like eating pastry all the time or something like that, you know, and this has now become the norm that everyone is supposed to have. And I'm thinking about the expansion of the Roman Empire with the church as well. The wheat fields that were tied to the church, and how you fed the armies was with, like, you know, bread and pasta and everything else coming out of the Roman Empire, you know?
I mean, when you realize the enormity of the implications of this, that, you know, really what you eat, what we think of as normal, is creating most of the health problems that we are seeing. It's not only what we're eating, it's not, you know, what we're not eating in its stead. If you're eating white bread, you're not having poached eggs or something for breakfast, you know? So you're... Yeah. And some of these foods are called anti-nutrients, in that not only do they, because actually digestion is quite an expensive process, you know, metabolically, the body uses a lot of resources up to digest food. And if it's putting all that effort in, you know, to digesting a candy bar or a white fluffy roll or something like that, not only is it spending all of those B vitamins and, you know, minerals and what have you, it's getting a negative payback at the end. So in this way, you know, our systems become completely depleted over a lifetime. We've just come back from holiday and they had a buffet breakfast, as a lot of these places do. And, well, you know, a lot of it is cereals and pastries, as you say, and bread and all the rest of it. I mean, they did also have eggs and bacon and stuff like that, which, you know, I would say is much healthier. So, you know, that's what we chose. But, you know, looking over to a table of little children next to me, of course, what they want is, you know, sweetened cereal and, you know, and that's what their mummies give them. And you know, the advertising tells them it's healthy because it's, you know, got added vitamins or something. It's just horrendous, really.
It is. It's horrible to see it. Yeah.
Just going back to the impact of the introduction of agriculture, because this is the other, you know, I think in addition to toxic metals, these are the two big things. The other was the introduction of agriculture. So the introduction of dairy products and the introduction of grains, and particularly gluten-containing grains. I think the diet we're supposed to eat really is a Paleolithic diet. So, you know, anything Paleolithic man wouldn't have got his hands on, you shouldn't really be eating. But they certainly found from the fossil record, when they introduced agriculture, there was a 7-inch loss in the height of men. There was a 5-inch loss, average loss, in the height of women. And also there's a massive increase in infant mortality and, you know, morbidity during birth and what have you, which relates to Weston Price's work showing that the pelvises have narrowed, making, you know, childbirth really problematic. So, you know, it's now in some regions it's 10,000 years because agriculture was introduced as the ice sheets retreated, and you know it retreated over a period of quite a long, you know, north over 5,000 years or something like that. And in some places they're just introducing agriculture now. I saw on the news today that there's fires in Sumatra and they're burning off forests to plant palm oil apparently. And it's caused a problem with being able to breed in, you know, neighboring countries and what have you. But, you know, this is what we're doing the world over.
Let me ask you this before we proceed there, because it's always interesting, and I just want to get people's theories on this. But why did this happen, do you think? How come we went from a previous way of life and then just all of a sudden we change it? I mean, it doesn't happen overnight, but, you know, if we look historically on it, it's a fairly quick process that it begins to spread across the globe, you know?
That's probably a whole other topic, but it all seemed to have come out of Sumer and with remarkable rapidity as well. One crop after another, you know, vines and cows.
And they're genetically changed to fit the human digestive system. There's an alteration taking place in them, you know, within the seeds and the crop.
Yes, you know, I think a lot of these things just haven't been recorded prior to that time. So you may want to draw your own conclusions about how they arrived.
Sure. It's a question I wanted to throw out there anyway, so people can think about it. What happened there? And we can move on in the story if you want to, Alison.
Yeah, sure. I don't know where you want me to go from there. So,
well, let me ask you about this then. It kind of follows on a little bit on that. But basically, do you think that it was in any way intentional to be in a position where we now basically have created a weak and feeble population compared to how we used to be as human beings?
It's certainly possible. That's certainly been the effect, whether it was intended or not. And because it's happened so slowly, you know, we don't see it. But, you know, one in three people will be diagnosed with cancer now. And there's nothing normal about this. And heart disease, again, it was practically unheard of a century ago. And now, I don't know, I think it's half, you know, of the population, or one in three or whatever, will get heart disease. I mean, these diseases were just, you know, they're not natural to our condition at all, but we've come to accept them as being so because they're commonplace. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean normal.
No, exactly. And, of course, education is the only way of getting around this and starting questioning why all of these things are happening. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the idea of raw food versus cooked food and what happens in the gut, and if it's true in what you've researched, Alison, that the body actually treats a lot of the cooked food as being toxic, basically.
Yeah, I don't quite say, you know, I think some people do eat all raw and some people do well on it. Some people even eat raw meats. I think that's probably a bit risky, to be honest, because of the parasite situation and, you know, all the other things. But I certainly think that you should try and eat some raw food every day. So that's, you know, a salad or fruit salad. I put raw eggs in my, you know, smoothies and things like that. So I think an effort should be made to have unaltered proteins, because heating does change the structure of proteins. I mean, I think the other thing is, you know, we've all been told over the years that we're here by accident, you know, that we've arisen from, you know, a mistake. There was a chemical soup, and then there was maybe a lightning strike that produced DNA and miraculously produced the means for reproducing it at the same time, and all of this sort of thing. And then the whole idea of evolution, and, you know, that just humankind has arisen spontaneously through a series of accidents. Well, if you don't buy that story and you think, well, actually, we're here on purpose and we've been put in our ideal environments, because that was what Weston Price showed. It didn't matter where you were or what you were eating. These people were all in robust health, no matter whether they were Inuits living on, you know, seal blubber, or Maasai tribesmen living on, you know, something completely
blood
different.
Blood and milk,
yeah. So, yes, I think if you accept that we were pushing our right environment, and that I've lost my thread there.
No, it's okay. It's basically about if there's a reason to the madness, then things are going to be in wherever we're born. Things are going to be in our environment that we can sustain ourselves on and live in a healthy life basically.
I think so, and I think, of course, I'm probably a mixture of Viking, Celt, and Anglo-Saxon, you know, so I've been, my heredity has predisposed me to be able to, you know, exist in the Northern Hemisphere on the foods that you find there, so, you know, fish and, you know, cabbage and that sort of stuff, whereas, you know, if you're born in Jamaica or something like that, you'll have a completely different makeup and the heredity aspect as well. So I think we've mixed it all up, really, for good or ill.
Yep, we have. And today politics have gotten into that discussion as well, and it's all very politically correct, and we can't say that we're different and anything else. So that it just further harms everything that, you know, that goes back to trying to find a point in history where things were, you know, really normal, not the new normal, as they call it.
Yes, I mean, this whole idea of the fall, you know, that we lived in a garden of Eden and that we had all we needed and it was all supplied, and then something happened and we lost that connection. And, you know, just watching the birds on holiday, for instance, they all came and drank from the swimming pool. And you know that the water in the swimming pool must have been good. Otherwise, the birds have the intelligence to know. I don't know how they know these things, but they do know these things. And I think we have that knowing, and we've been, you know, we've lost that knowing. We've been disconnected from that knowing. And now we have this whole business of science and, you know, double blind studies, and they say this and they say that and everything, because we don't know anymore. These native people just knew. They inherently knew what they needed. And, you know, some of them, Weston Price in particular, looked for a vegetarian tribe that was healthy. He really wanted, you know, that was something he was intent on. Mm. And he couldn't find one. He found some that ate a lot of fruit and vegetables. But even then, they traded with local tribes, crabs and things like that.
Really?
Yeah, to get some essential, you know, nutrients. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to make another point, by the way, as well, in terms of raw and switching and changing diet radically or too quick as well. I think that's something that can be also very difficult for us, of course, detoxing and everything else. But this idea that, as you said, Alison, if we haven't lived a life of eating a lot of raw things, we can't just switch over magically and think that everything is going to be good. I think that there's a long process. We might have generations behind us of eating the wrong thing, and I think that we will have that makeup with us. So our transition needs to be thoughtful and careful and slow. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, I was a vegetarian for quite a long time, and I mean, I knew from my 20s, you know, I had digestive problems, as I say, from early childhood, and I knew from my 20s that my diet was the answer. It held the clues. But, you know, it's been 30 years of kind of experimenting, trying different things to see what works. And I met a friend for lunch the other day in a health food cafe, and literally everything was wheat. Literally everything. Yeah. I couldn't eat a single thing in there. It was all quiches and pastries and cakes and, you know, biscuits and cookies and... And, you know, and I thought that was healthy too 20 or 30 years ago, if it was, you know, organic and stone ground or wholemeal or something like that. I mean, I couldn't be further from, I don't think that's further from the truth if you could try.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've been misled about an awful lot of things. And I think really, I mean, the only rule is that if you're being told to do it by the government, it's probably wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
Just ignore all of that, you know.
You have to unlearn and learn anew and discover.
Yes, and you know, because people are, I mean, my husband is a naturally slim person and I can't get fruit and vegetables into him, you know, for trying. But he's in very good health. You know, he's practically never has a day sickness. He maintains his perfect weight and he does everything quite wrong, you know. And he'll eat the fat on, you know, gammon or lamb or anything like that. But, you know, according to Weston Price, this is exactly what we should be doing because that's where all the vitamins are. Yeah. You know, we should be adding fat to things. We need saturated fat.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. That's a good thing, because we have all this the new scientific, you know, margarines and trans fats and everything else moving in, and everything is moving away from fat. Like, that fat is dangerous, and everything, you know, not everything, but a lot of sections in the grocery store is aimed towards targeting people who don't want to have fat. What kind of effect does this have? How dangerous it is to is it to exclude the fat from our diet, Alison?
Well, this is what Weston Price showed when he did his analysis of all the foods there, was that we have one-tenth the fat-soluble vitamins of these, at least one-tenth the fat-soluble vitamins of these native peoples who develop so beautifully. You know, most of your body is fat and protein. I mean, those are what you need. All this obesity, all this diabetes, you know, we're told... Because if you're not eating fat, you're eating carbohydrate, basically. Because when they take the fat out, they have to put something in, and they're not going to be putting protein in because that's expensive. So, you know, all these low-fat foods are basically high-carbohydrate foods.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a disaster. I mean, look around you, you know. And even when people have got diabetes, they then give them medicine so they can carry on eating high-carbohydrate diets.
Yeah,
and actually tell them to do it. You know, it's insane.
Removing fat will not make you slim, but removing wheat and carbohydrates, as you said, will.
Yes, I mean, there's some very compelling evidence. I'll see if I can find you. There's a video that shows some of the nutritionists and who are overweight and their advice, and then some of the ones who advocate the Paleolithic, and, you know, and they're all lovely and lean and muscular and what have you. But, you know, our bodies are fat. All our cell membranes are fat. The work of Bruce Lipton showed that the intelligence of the body is actually in the cell membrane. And when that is corrupted by trans fats and things like that, the whole communication system from the cell to the body and to the wider environment breaks down. And that's really where health starts to come apart. And it's something like 2/3 of the dry weight of the brain is fat. You know, it insulates our nerves. It's used for, you know, hormone manufacture, and it's just crazy. It's the type of fat. You know, I think you want natural, clean fats, and that's actually a problem because, you know, animals store their toxins in their fat as well. So, you know, fat has become progressively toxic, animal fats. Interestingly, while we were on holiday, we went to a Uruguayan steak bar in Portugal, but in Uruguay, all meat, or certainly all beef, by law, has to be grass-fed, organic, no antibiotics. You know, it's just, I mean, the whole, you know, the government has taken that stance, and that's the way meat should be. It should have been grass-fed. It shouldn't be fed on, you know, cattle nuts or whatever. And
people should have the brains to realize that. The government shouldn't have to tell them that.
No, but it's completely altered the profile of fats that you get in meat. Because, you know, the truth is we can't do a truly Paleolithic diet because, you know, we're not hunting game and what have you. So we can only do the next best thing, really. But yes, it has altered the profile of the fats you find in meat and animal fat completely. But there are, you know, there is a growing movement towards raw milk, and particularly Weston Price's thing was high vitamin butter. Because that contained, you know, a lot of the nutrients you needed for proper development.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can get that over the internet and what have you. But, you know, I mean, I think there's two sources in the UK, and one of them's currently embroiled in litigation. You know,
yeah.
So they're trying to close down all these avenues.
EU on top of that, Alison, makes it even worse with...
Yeah,
banning herbs, and I mean, the craziness just continues. It's unbelievable. Controlling food and controlling everything, vitamins. And,
yes, you know. And the only thing you can do is take personal responsibility and make sure your diet is as good as you can get it. And as I say, you know, in my books, that is eating a Paleolithic diet or as close as you can get, and eating some raw and drinking plenty of water, that sort of thing. I think if you start adding supplements on and you've got an inadequate diet, then, you know, that's not a good way to go. You have to get the diet sorted first.
Very good. Now, there's so much more to talk about here, of course, and in a little bit we're going to take a break when I talk, as I said before, about your books and website. But can we talk a little bit about detoxing of mercury before we take a break? How did you go about that? Is there a way to kind of encapsulate that a little bit of how one would go about doing that if they need to?
Well, I went about it the long way because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just feeling my way really first. But I would say the first thing you need to do is make sure that your routes of excretion are open and ready to take the mercury as you mobilize it. So for the two main routes of excretion are out through the colon in the feces and out through the kidneys in the urine. The kidneys have probably taken a hammering from mercury and toxic metals and all that sort of thing. And there are things you can take, herbs you can take to support the kidneys and that sort of thing. But the really important thing is to get your colon cleaned out at the start. If you don't do this, then you might get some really kind of quite nastier reactions than you need to get as stuff backs up into your system. The majority of mercury is excreted in the bile, and that's produced in the liver, and then it's stored in the gallbladder and concentrated in the gallbladder, and then the gallbladder squirts into the duodenum, which is just below the stomach, along with pancreatic juices. And the idea is that you want to trap the mercury in the bile into the chyme, as it's called. So you need to have fiber there to absorb that and to take it out through the body, because it will be reabsorbed further down in the colon if you don't do that. So you need to get your colon cleaned out first, which could be a series of colonic hydrotherapy. It could be you can get stuff over the internet and things, mucoid plaque cleanse, which is actually what I'd probably recommend. It's a little bit hardcore because you have to do a liquid diet for several days. Mm-hmm. But I did it fairly late on in the process, but with the value of hindsight, I would say you need to start there really. So get your colon clean, and then you need to understand that what we label illness is actually detoxification. You need to understand that up front. So when you start to feel poorly, because you will, probably, you need to understand that that's what's happening. You're detoxifying stuff.
Let's clarify that again, that if you're doing something and changing something, and initially if you feel not well doing that, that means that you're detoxing.
Most likely. I mean, it could mean that you've introduced a food that you're intolerant to, or, there are some other possibilities.
Is there an easy way of knowing that? Which one is which?
Typical detox symptoms include just feeling generally lousy, maybe feeling quite emotional. What the natural world think happens is that toxins get laid down in layers, along with emotional traumas and that sort of thing. So as you're releasing, it's a little bit hard to understand because it's almost like a holographic thing or whatever, but as you're releasing emotions, perhaps as you, resolve something, you may release a cargo of toxins along with it. And equally, when you're detoxing, chemically taking supplements, that sort of thing, you may be releasing the emotions that trap those toxins in the first place as well. So it's a bit of a kind of emotional roller coaster. Flu-like symptoms, so runny nose, that sort of thing, sinus, swollen tonsils, gut problems, so loose stools, diarrhea, tends to disrupt your sleep, particularly mercury, I think, and other toxic metals as well. What we would label flu and a cold and, kind of food poisoning type symptoms, those are all typical detox symptoms. It is said that the body will have three attempts at trying to resolve something and get rid of something. And then if you keep suppressing it, which is now I realize what had happened for 40 years for me, I'd been, every time I had, quote, cold or the flu, I'd gone and taken antibiotics or whatever. It just goes deeper and deeper and deeper into the body. So you've got to let it come to the surface and out and try not to frustrate it, by suppressing the symptom. And it's very hard to undo. My niece's boyfriend was recently knocked off his bike and unfortunately broke his fall with his face, and his teeth came out through his lip. And I said to her, without thinking, oh, put you know, put some cold peas on it. And then I rang her back afterwards and said, no, don't put cold peas on it. You know, let the body get as inflamed as it needs to, because the body knows how, you know, the body is vastly intelligent. It knows how inflamed it needs to be to clean up, you know, the debris and get the whole healing thing going.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
You know, so, but, you know, we've just been taught all this suppressive stuff. And that's why we're all getting chronically sick, because we suppress symptoms. So if I had one message to say to your listeners, it's just, you know, trust your body over what the doctor says, unless it's real life and death stuff, you know, and just let your body do what it needs to do. It's been doing it for millions of years. Our bodies know what they, you know, need to do to get healthy, but we've labeled the detox disease, and the doctor will suppress your fever or will give you antibiotics or will, you know, he will, because that's what he's been trained, or he or she.
Yeah, so like a cold is something that you should go through, because it's a detox process.
It is a detox. And, you know, I think, I'm not saying you can't catch cold or flu, because I think there are, you know, other factors at work. But basically it is, it's a cleansing process. And if you look and see how you felt before you had a cold or the flu, quote, and afterwards, you will always see that your health has improved in some way. Because you've just had a massive spring clean, you know, and I know it's horrible. And I've had, since Christmas, actually, until quite recently, I've had, you know, just a horrible cough and rashes and things like that. But, you know, I'm really starting to notice my health improving massively now. And one of the principles in naturopathy is that sick systems can't respond, really, and only vigorous systems can respond and kick this stuff out. So you have to, you know, it's actually a really good sign if you get really acutely sick, because it means your body's getting stronger and it's kicking out layer after layer of, you know, toxins. So you just got to hang in there and forget everything you were ever told. Don't see the doctor unless, as I say, it's life and death. And just, you know, ride the storms, really, and make yourself as comfortable as you can. But like with the cough, I mean, it is really hard when, you know, I wasn't sleeping well at all. And, you know, after a couple of weeks of that, you get so worn down, you think, well, perhaps I should go. But, I, you know, I was absolutely determined that I wasn't, and I was just going to see it through.
I understand that. Definitely. It's. I agree with you. It's. I think the body has an intelligence, and it knows what to do. It's running the whole show, if you will, in terms of, you know, the function of our physicality. We don't decide much. We don't have any control over what... Well, maybe a little bit partially, but I'm suggesting that someone has made the other example that if we eat, for example, we do not guide the process of the body of what to release and how to, you know, put that through the system and how to extract things and everything. It's just, it goes on automatic. It handles by itself. We don't have to think about it.
Yeah. That's all part of the program.
Very good. Now, let's talk about the book a little bit, The Natural Recovery Plan. Because it's really good. It has some interesting, not only the knowledge in it, of course, but you have some interesting, good diagnosis sections in it as well, Alison, in terms of like how to possibly discover if we do have mercury toxicity and stuff like that. Tell us a little bit more about the book.
Yeah, well, the full title is Chronic Fatigue, ME, and that confuses some people because it's myalgic encephalomyelopathy or encephalomyelitis, which is a term that has been used in the UK for chronic fatigue for, I don't know, 30, 40 years or something. So the title is Chronic Fatigue, ME and Fibromyalgia, The Natural Recovery Plan. It's available on both my websites, which are www.thenaturalrecoveryplan.com and www.mouthbodydoctor.com. What I do is I spend the first half of the book just outlining a different paradigm and a different way of looking at these fatiguing illnesses. Although the title refers to chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, I think this is true of all chronic, serious and degenerative illnesses, particularly autoimmune diseases. There are now over 100 autoimmune diseases, and they all affect women 9 times more often and more commonly than men. So I would say to anybody who's got some kind of mysterious illness, or anybody who's sick and, you know, is serious about taking control and wanting to get better, take a look. On both of my websites, I've got a mercury toxicity questionnaire, an interactive one. So you can go there, you can fill that in, and then see whether your symptoms are, could be mercury toxicity. And in my books, if your cells are expressing the symptoms of mercury toxicity, it's because you're mercury toxic. some people disagree with that. Some people want to see it in urine tests or blood tests or hair or nails or something. But for a whole host of reasons, you may not find it there because it's attached to the central nervous system and to the cell organelles and that sort of thing. So notoriously difficult to diagnose. And I would say having had negative tests in the past just definitely doesn't rule out the possibility of mercury toxicity. So there's a whole host of symptoms. I can give you some of them if you're interested.
Yeah, sure. Let's do that. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, digestive problems are a really big one. Insomnia, depression, poor memory, difficulty concentrating, muscle and joint aches and pains. That's the fibromyalgia bit. Hormonal and reproductive problems, poor response to stress, feeling cold a lot, having cold hands and feet, fatigue, constant infections, allergies and sensitivities, respiratory problems, mood swings, tremors, that sort of thing. So it's a real big, well, that's why they call it a syndrome, because it affects, you know, it expresses itself differently in different people according to a host of different factors. But, you know, consider it, as I say, if you are not getting any joy out of the standard approach, if you're serious about staying healthy and you want to recover your health and you're chronically sick, and then just buckle your belt because it's going to be a slightly rocky ride. So in the first half of the book, I explain the whole paradigm. I explain about toxic metals. I explain about mercury and how it's got into the whole system and been passed from generation to generation. And then in the second half of the book, I give a protocol, step-by-step protocol for DIY mercury detoxification. Now, some people really do need professional help. But I wrote this book when I realized the scale of this problem. I wrote this book knowing that tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people have this problem and they're not all going to be able to access the care they need or, you know, to afford it either. So I wrote this book with, you know, somebody in some small town in Ohio in mind, you know, what can they do? So it's a DIY guide to, you know, detoxing mercury. You do have to look at getting your amalgam fillings out as well. And it's actually, you need to have that done carefully. And that may be not the first thing to do, depending on how sick you are. Sometimes you need to create some detoxification capacity if you're really sick before you even think about that, because it actually imposes an even bigger burden on the body because more mercury is released when you have that work done.
Yeah. So you give this suggestion in the book of how to go about this and do this in an intelligent way, as you've gone through much of this yourself and experimented along the way.
I do. And, and I also give people at the end of the book, you know, how to manage the thing, you know, if they're having unpleasant symptoms, a kind of table of, you know, what to do and that sort of thing. So I also encourage people to use muscle testing to get familiar with that. And then that's a way of dialoguing with your body, because I can give protocols, but, you know, not everybody's the same. Not everybody needs the same thing for the same length of time. So you need to ask your body. That's the only way, you know, and once you've cracked that, I don't know how people can work without that, to be honest. But and also you're accessing this vast intelligence, this vast database. So even if I don't understand the answers I'm getting, I just stuck with them and just did what my body requested at each particular turn. So every couple of weeks I would just check and that sort of thing, and then just do what it said. And if it said it wasn't the right time to get your amalgams out, well, it's not the right time, you know, and I delayed. So, but trust your body and trust your own, because we've been so divorced from our own innate, you know, intelligence and knowing, and we've been told so many things that are, you know, are true that aren't. And you've got to reaccess all of that and ignore everything you've been told about diet and health. For me, the compelling piece of evidence is that doctors live a shorter life expectancy than the rest of us. So, you know, their advice is probably not worth following, is it? You know, just based on that alone.
And Lana's always told me as well about the statistics of dentists, that they have higher suicide rates than any other field, I think.
Dentists have got an absolutely diabolical health record, and there's been some dispute about this, but there was a study done last year, and I've actually got an article about it, and I've done some videos related to it as well, if people want to go to my website and put in, you know, mercury poisoning in dentists or something like that. But there was a study done last year by to Plinsky and Cicchetti, and it was done out of Yale, I think. And what they did was they took statistics from the medical insurance statistics from the northeast of the United States. So these are people who, you know, were taking the drug because they weren't relying upon their memory and, you know, reports and that sort of thing. This is actual hard data. And they compared male dentists, general dentists, to the rest of the population. And, well, first of all, they were the biggest drug users, you know, pharmaceutical drug users, utilizers of the system, compared to all other groups. Yes, certainly dentists are commit suicide 7 times as often as the rest of the population. But they just found absolutely, you know, incontrovertible data that it is harming people. They're also 7 times more likely to get neurological disorders. Half of them end their working lives with heart disease, on heart disease medications. And anyway, I'd encourage people who are interested in the details to go and look at that study or my write-up of it. But it's poisoning dentists and they don't know it.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, they're the first in, you know, they're the first in the firing line. They're removing the stuff, placing the stuff. Every time you put a cartridge in the amalgamator and it gets mixed, it's hot. When you open it up, all the vapor comes out. You know, you're working in an entirely toxic environment. I think, you know, my prayer is that we look back in, you know, as little as 20 years and think, what were we thinking? Because I think it's one of the most toxic jobs you could possibly do in this day and age if you don't know what you're doing. And
that's
not protecting
right.
yourself and not protecting your staff. That's the other thing, because these are, you know, often young girls who haven't had their babies. You know,
yeah, it's
so
true.
They're going to pass it on and, you know, have fertility problems, all that sort of thing. So it needs to be taken incredibly seriously, because it is incredibly serious. And it's incredibly, you know, it is a long, difficult business, getting rid of the stuff. But I just would counsel people that I don't think there's any other answer if that's the actual cause. You know, you just got to go through it.
Indeed. Yeah. All right. Well, very good. Good words, Alison. Good things to round up the first hour. We're going to continue, of course, in the second. There's more I want to talk about, like chronic fatigue, endocrine disorders, natural dentistry, and more on the mouth-body connection as well. But in the meantime, then, check out the websites, thenaturalrecoveryplan.com, and also mouthbodydoctor.com, and the book is called Chronic Fatigue, ME, and Fibromyalgia. What's that, they're at? Fibromyalgia,
yep.
The Natural Recovery Plan. All right, well, stay with us, Alison. We'll be right back with more.
An unseen force behind the turning leaves drives them all for million MPs. You never gave up on me somehow, and I don't know why I haven't turned by now. To open up and find a way. swirling cloud. The other birds are off and flying south. We'll have to make